particular situation. I've discussed that exact situation with the FAA, and they told me that if it happened, I could sue them. And I said, gee, that doesn't sound like a very good suit. I mean, they're going to destroy two of my tower sections that are worth $180 a piece, and in their case, they lose an aircraft worth $250,000 and put two people's lives in danger, and after that, the aircraft crashes into a house nearby. I mean, I wouldn't be suing them in a case like that, and they wouldn't be suing me because I'm within the rules. So whenever you're applying for a ham radio license, on the application in the old days, they used to tell you that if your antenna exceeds 200 feet above grade, then yes, you must apply for an FAA permit for the antenna, in which case you will appear on the aeronautical chart, on the sectional chart, as a potential hazard to air navigation. And as you can see, even in the case of the 200 foot, there is still the 800 foot safety zone between the top of your antenna and the 1,000 foot rating that they're not supposed to exceed. So I think it's not a problem. Anyone else got any further comments on this one? Give me a call with us right now.
Vic, I'm not talking about regular airplanes. I'm talking about VFOs, that things that fly from other planets and that stuff. W2EWK clear.
It's J2KEY, Dick. I have a serious comment.
Okay, I'm ready to. Yeah, you called it VFO and you meant UFO, unidentified flying object. Most of us don't worry about that, Eugene. I know you do. And you might be right. Most of us, in our innocence, we don't worry about UFOs striking our antennas. Mel, you've got it.
Now, you know what I went through here with the building department, et cetera, and they limited me to a 85-foot tower. And I said, for what reason am I limited? Because I was surely ready for a 100-foot tower. And they said to me, because of helicopters here along the coast to patrol, along the beach, the police and all fly below the 1,000-foot level deck, over.
Yes, and you're absolutely right. I have seen the Suffolk County Police Department fly their helicopters at my estimation of 500 feet above grade in my neighborhood. They're violating FAA rules when they do that. If they struck my antenna, they would be in violation, not me. In your particular case, I guess you were speaking to someone who recommended you not exceed 85 feet. But unless you're in the glide slope of a particular airport and you're the right number of miles from the airport that restricts you to 85 feet, I think it is my guess you were being intimidated. That if you really wanted to go to 100 feet, I think you could do it. They're not supposed to be below 1,000 foot in residential area. The beach, technically, if the guy's really over the waterline of the beach, could be called a rural area, and he's allowed to come down to 500 feet legally. Beyond that, I don't see why that should restrict you to an 85-foot altitude for your tower. Am I missing something here, Mel? Go ahead.
I wasn't going to have a lot of fights with them, because they just, boy, they were, you don't know what they're like to deal with to begin with. Just to even get this doggone permit, they didn't have even a category for it at the time. They finally put it into the category of adding a fire escape to the building. So this is, of course, quite a number of years ago. The discussion with them, I said, you mean to tell me if I go up 100 feet? He says, oh, we're going to come and check this, of course. You know, I had to get the permit initially. Then I had to show bills with the amount of concrete that was poured, you know, receipts for the concrete. What else did they check here? Oh, they came here, they put a level up against it, checked it for plumb, and actually cited it to see that I did not exceed. Now, they've got some strange laws and regulations here, I wasn't going to really do it to any great extent with them, because as it is, it took me months to get this permit. They just wouldn't issue it initially. So I had to get, you know, from the company originally, engineering specifications on strength, you know, a lot of ridiculous technicality. But when it came to the height, I tried, I questioned it, I did whatever I could, and they said, listen, you go above the 85, we're not going to okay it, you know, without with the building block, you don't get an okay here, you got problems. So I didn't want to really rock the boat, because I saw it was already in agitation. taking place there when I insisted on going 100 feet. So I had to just limit it to 85, but we got the check. Now, it's different. I don't know, really, if it's only FAA. It could be local building ordinances and things that, you know, building departments and all. As it is, you know, they can, you know, a lot of places, they have these covenants that you can't even put nothing up. You can't take a piece of wire literally out the window. So I don't know what, you know, individual towns all over the country, what their criteria is, but you know, you've got to really battle it out almost in every instant. And they'll say, well, we're accommodating you at 85 feet. This, you should be satisfied. So you have to take some time, you know, a little bit of a step back and not pursue it if you want to, you know, unless you want to get to a lot of red tape. And I didn't want to put this thing off because the weather was warm. I know it had to either go in now or it wasn't going in, to tell you the truth, over.
I see where you're coming from, Mel. In that situation, I would agree with you, and I would have done the same thing. Each of us as ham radio operators, when you're about to buy a new piece of property, really have to do a pretty thorough check of what's called CC&Rs. I keep forgetting what the first C stands for, but the second is covenants and restrictions. Anybody know what the first C stands for? Apparently not, but CC&Rs are all of the restrictions of your zoning codes and local building codes, and town ordinances, and maybe even county ordinances and so on. And so we have to check on that before we buy a piece of property, otherwise life gets kind of complicated. Because many of us as ham radio operators are eventually going to want to put up a tower. And those towers are treated emotionally by many town residents. I, as a member of the committee that tries to defend ham radio operators, I guess I've given court testimony on 13, 14, 15 occasions as a member of DART, D-A-R-T, Defend Amateur Radio Towers, an organization that included NORM, K2YEW, among Fred N2, I mean Frank N2FF and others. We have all gone around defending amateur radio towers, and rather successfully. Of the 13 or 14 cases, only one case did we lose, and that particular case was an extremely complicated one. We knew that was a tough one going into it. So what we've seen is that some zoning boards, like, for instance, Fayetteville, very accommodating to ham radio operators. Smithtown, very accommodating. Riverhead, very accommodating. Kings Park, very accommodating. Huntington has become very accommodating. Oyster Bay, sometimes extremely accommodating, sometimes quite tough. Oyster Bay Township. Depends on which individual community you live in, so to speak. But many of the communities are rapidly coming to the conclusion that ham radio operators are a very beneficial group, and don't thwart their efforts to do good communication, particularly where we're backed up by DRB1, DRB2, and now the Department of Homeland Security. The Department of Homeland Security is very concerned about the fact that the amount of backup radio communication for 9/11-like situations, in their opinion, is quite inadequate. That when a report card is issued for the metropolitan New York area, the report card usually comes back mediocre in capability for sustaining such a situation. The next person who signed in was Fred. Hope we haven't kept you waiting too long. Fred, KC2, Oboe Echo Sierra, if I got it right. K2RIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick. You got it, Fred.
KC2, QIQ with a quick comment.
QIQ, go right ahead.
Yeah, that's middle word you were looking for was conditions and restrictions.
Thank you. Covenants, conditions, and restrictions. And the covenants and conditions strike me as somewhat synonymous words, and that's probably part of the reason why I couldn't remember it. Thank you, Glenn. Fred, you've got it.
Good evening to all. Hi, Dick. Since getting my amateur license for the last 2 years, 7 months approximately, no, it's actually more than that, 2.5 years, and being very handy, I built a lot of J-poles, 2 meter, 220, 6 meter, and collinear them, and I recently took on a project to build a J-beam. The man I'm referencing is N3SDO, J-Beam Project. I decided to make it five elements following the rules. But I noticed something recently, that some of the antennas, the J-poles, in the photos, or the actual words of, in the articles themselves, some of them feed the driven element, the long element, and some feed the stub. And I have another question that refers to material size versus wattage capability.
Okay, I see where you're going here, Fred, and you're into an extremely good subject. One of the best kept secrets that, to my knowledge, other than Mel and Dick, we have this little chunk of knowledge that we're telling anybody who will listen. It's a secret among us ham radio operators, but it's not in any of the respected good antenna books. And I must own 30 or 35 books on the subject of antennas. My consulting business is strictly on the subject of antennas. I develop antennas for various clients, and as of the last 5 years, I have filed 15 antenna patents, something like six or seven of which have already been granted on antennas. So I claim a track record on antennas. And what the books are keeping secret is that that signal you come out of your transmitter with, you send it down the transmission line, and if the antenna is the right resistive impedance, if you're running 50-ohm cable and your antenna is a 50-ohm resistor at your frequency, the signal flows down that cable once, never comes back, enters the antenna, and then what happens? The signal bounces back and forth on the antenna roughly 30 times before it's radiated into space. The well-kept secret is that radiation is difficult. You have to kick that signal in the tail 30 times before it finally leaves that antenna. It doesn't, you know, just suddenly jump off at the 30th bounce. Obviously, 3% of it is jumping off on each bounce, so to speak, on average. It's really an infinite series chunk of mathematics. It's an exponential decay, and so on. In other words, when you first put the leading edge of a pulse into your antenna is really a kind of a flywheel. You're building up a signal into that flywheel, very similar to what happens with a small push rod on a very large flywheel. It's got a Q of 30, so to speak. I'm talking about the dipole of a dipole antenna, a J-pole antenna, a quarter-wave monopole, a dipole that's part of a Yagi antenna. It doesn't matter. They all have this characteristic. So no matter where you feed the antenna, whether you're feeding the stub, the antenna, whether you're feeding it in an inductive manner or a capacitive manner, a voltage manner or a magnetic field manner, with a coupling loop, there's a zillion ways you can get the energy into the antenna. If it was an ordinary dipole, you can get the energy in there by feeding the center. You can feed the ends with a folded dipole. You can feed one side with a gamma match, a T match, a delta match. There's a zillion ways you can get the energy on the antenna. All of those ways, properly implemented, all have nearly 100% efficiency. You're feeding energy into a flywheel. When the flywheel builds up that energy and the signal is bouncing back 30 times before it gets radiated in space, once you realize that it has such a high Q structure, which portion of the structure you feed doesn't matter, as long as it gives you a good impedance match to your transmission line, and as long as it has the proper balancing function, which means it doesn't relaunch signal down the outside of your coax cable. That's not necessarily bad, but if the outside of your coax cable is part of the radiation, then you're going to have a different pattern, and in some cases, you're going to have some television interference. So once you see it from that point of view, once you realize what an antenna is, to properly resonate the antenna really means that all of those 30 bounces stay co-phased with each other. They all stay lockstep, in step with each other. If the antenna is a little bit short in length, those bounces start leading in phase, and we call that a capacitive antenna. It isn't because the antenna is really a capacitor. It acts like a capacitor because the 30 bounces start leading in phase because the antenna is too short. Or if the antenna is a little bit too long, it starts lagging in phase, and we say the antenna is inductive. It acts like an inductor, but it isn't really an inductor. It just electronically acts like one because of this bouncing phenomenon. So what part of the J-pole you feed almost doesn't matter. I'm going to jump into the next step here, Fred, and that is, when you're using a substitute material for an antenna, Let's assume that your particular antenna designer told you to use a quarter-inch diameter welding rod, and you're using a 3/16 of an inch diameter rod instead, and you've readjusted the length accordingly to bring it back into resonance because it has a little bit of different capacitance on the tip because you're changing diameter. Any of the substitution you make in materials could or could not do a minor amount of detuning of the antenna, and you're a smart enough guy to sweep it and measure the standing wave ratio and plot it, and it's going to be a bathtub-shaped curve, and at the center of the curve, down at the bottom, is at your favorite frequency. You're happy, and you say, aha, the antenna is resonant at my favorite frequency. The next thing you worry about with a substitution of materials is, have you created an insertion loss? And there's an extremely effective way you can find that out. Put 100 watts into the antenna for 10 minutes. T down. Turn off the transmitter real fast, run over there, and touch everything. If the antenna is ice cold, there ain't no loss. If you had 1 watt of loss somewhere in the antenna out of 100, and you did it for 10 minutes, 1 watt of loss in some small component is going to give you an amount of heat that your hand will feel immediately when you turn off the transmitter and go over there and touch it. 1 watt of loss out of 100 is 99% efficiency. It's something like 0.01 dB of insertion loss. That thermal test that I just described with your hand is an extremely sensitive test that can measure very small amounts of loss. But other than your hand, you'd be amazed what kind of laboratory test equipment accuracy would have been required to resolve that small amount of the loss. So when you substitute the antennas and you pass the thermal test, you've got it made. The more sophisticated version of that that I'm using professionally is I'm now using a thermal imaging camera, and I look at the antenna while it is transmitting to find out which portion of it are getting hot. And hot being defined as 1 or 2 degrees Fahrenheit rise in temperature, so that it looks different on an infrared camera. That's a very sensitive test. But your hand is the next best thing, the poor man's equivalent, and does an excellent job. And once you pass that test, Fred, you've got it made. Of all the RF energy you plug into your antenna, there's only three things your antenna can do with it. Number one, radiate it into space. That's good. Number two, send it back to you, back to the transmitter because of an impedance mismatch. Your standing wave ratio meter will show you that right away. Or number three, it burns up some amount of it with heat. But it can't burn up any of it with heat without something getting hot. KC2, OES, K2RIW, you got it, Fred.
Welcome to the W2DL repeater.
Okay, my second question is there a formula or calculations to be used to determine what size material will handle what wattage? I'm sure there's many variables. Can you explain?
Yeah. In most situations, Fred, the quickest thing that limits the power input of an antenna is the input connector itself. A type N connector, when you look at that and you look at those little ridges inside and whatever, your mind says, boy, that should flash over at some very low amount of power. A good buddy of mine named, having trouble thinking of his name right now, a guy who retired, it'll come to me in a minute, Hank Keane, W2CTK, Whiskey 2 Charlie Tango Kilowatt, was his call letters when he used to live in Comac. What he did was to put pulses of power through a type N connector with a local polonium source, giving him some cosmic rays, so to speak, some local gamma rays to make sure that if the air had a tendency to arc over, it would do so. He found out a type N connector for brief pulses of power has no trouble tolerating 20,000 watts, 20 kilowatts. That's the good news. The bad news is that T down, you put more than 1,000 watts through a type N connector with a 1-to-1 standing wave ratio, the current through the center pin starts heating up the center pin. And a little bit above 1,000 watts, the heat gets so high that the four little flutes of the female section of the center pin start separating. And once one of them separates and the three remaining ones try to pick up the current and they run hotter, you got a thermal runaway and it eventually arcs. So current heating of the center pin of your input connector, if it's a type N connector, is the usual limitation of any antenna. If you use a PL259 SO239 connector, which has got a much bigger center conductor, I think that connector could probably take 2, 3, maybe 4 or 5 kilowatts of power before the center pin burns up. So almost every connector, the real power limitation is heating due to current of the center conductor, the pin of the center conductor of the connector. SMA connector, which used to be called an OSM connector, as you approach 100 watts an hour frequencies, that connector is in trouble. A BNC connector can probably take something like 500 watts at hour frequencies, again, heating of the center conductor. So since the components of your antenna most likely are larger in diameter than the center pin little fluted, the neck down section of the center pin of a type N connector, since most of the components of your antenna are larger in diameter than that, and they're out in the air where they can get free dissipation of that heat, as long as you're not smaller in diameter than the neck down section of the male center pin of a type N connector, almost everything in your antenna should tolerate 1,000 watts, in my opinion. Back to you, Fred.
Okay, that question was basically in my effort to reduce weight, because I've modified the antenna to get more gain by making it 5 elements instead of 3 elements. I think I've solved some of the structural problems, but I still want to reduce the weight by changing. I'm using half-inch copper tubing, which is most of what my J-poles are, except for the 6-meter. The 6-meter was out of 3/4 inch. To reduce weight, I want to change the material that I'm using. I've got a wooden boom. It's 1.5 inches closet rod, basically. And I've adapted some PVC from both water and electrical that made up in order to stiffen the bottom of the radials of all the elements to tie them together to get some of the weight back into the mass. But it still is very end heavy, so that's why I asked that question, to try and reduce the weight.
Okay. Quarter inch diameter copper tubing as an antenna, under most circumstances, can probably take 5,000 watts because you've got 5 elements to the antenna. Whatever power you're putting into it is being divided by 5 to 1. If you put 1,000 watts into the antenna and you get 5 individual elements all being fed with a phasing harness, each antenna is only getting 200 watts. My guess is you could make those, for lightness reasons, if you wanted to, even considerably smaller in diameter. And again, you could do a series of experiments by putting a known amount of power into one antenna, as I said, for 10 minutes, or 1 minute would really do it, and turn off the transmitter and go over there and find out what gets hot. And if it runs ice cold, you could run it smaller in diameter if you wish to. When it comes to a formula telling you how many watts you could put into it, I don't know of a simple formula that'll give you that information, Fred, and there's a bunch of variables involved. In reality, if, for instance, that was, if we now get into the nitty-gritty, if that element was part of a Yagi structure, and now you've got cross-coupling between all of the parasitic elements and your driven element, life gets a little bit more complicated. In your particular case with the J-poles, you are going to be getting cross-coupling between the elements, depending on the length of the cable that feeds the elements from the power divider, the 5-to-1 power divider, if that's what there is, depending on the space of the elements. We're now talking about the energy fed between the elements, the cross-coupling, being in phase, out of phase, in quadrature, or whatever. There's a bunch of variables involved. Usually, if one particular element of a phased array can meet the 1/n power, if you've got 5 elements you're starting off with a kilowatt, you divide a kilowatt by 5, it's 200 watts per element. You put 200 watts per element and it runs ice cold. Most likely then you put that into an array of 5 elements. There'll be very little difference in the heating. But still, there's a darn many variables involved as to how open the antenna is to the air, where is the current concentration within the resonance phenomena of the antenna itself, is there a local soldering material that's high in resistivity. There's a whole bunch of variables. To try to do it as a formula is difficult. To build a sample of the antenna and test it, your answer you get is so fast and so accurate that that's what I recommend that you do. And in my opinion, you're going to be hard-pressed to build the antenna where it is electronically so flimsy that it runs hot to the touch, if you know what I mean. Fred. However, as you proceed with this project, I'd love to have you come back once it starts in operation, when it sees first light, as they say in the optical telescope world. When your antenna sees first light, come back and tell us how well it worked and how cool it runs. Sounds like you got a pretty cool antenna, and I'm using that as a double entendre. Back to you, Fred. KC2OES, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, two questions, then I'll get out of this one. I have some photos that I could send to you if you'd like. The other thing is, can I collinear it? Would that act as parasitic if I collinear the J-pole, the standard J-pole, and use it in the beam configuration?
You said collinear, and it was truly collinear, and it was vertically polarized, for instance. Each of the five antennas would be vertically stacked above each other, which, by the way, is essentially what you've got with a five-element collinear superstation master-like antenna. Properly done, it's going to give you a vertical beamwidth that's very small, like 10 degrees, and therefore the perpendicularity of the antenna is something to worry about. Once you build an omnidirectional collinear vertically polarized antenna, the good news is that the antenna pattern looks like a pancake. But boy, you better have that pancake on the horizon, not above the horizon as a general cone, or below the horizon as a general cone, or you better make sure everything is perpendicular to the ground. Otherwise, if to the east and the west, you're above the horizon on one side and below the horizon on the other side, it's going to hurt. What sometimes happens is when guys set up the phasing harness, they don't properly account for the group delay, or actually it's called phase delay. What is it called? Group velocity, phase velocity of your coax cable. If you don't properly account for that, you can end up with the upper antennas being fed slightly later in phase than the lower antennas of a collinear array. And a phased array always aims the beam in the direction of the delay. If the upper elements are getting the signal a little bit late, your beautiful pancake radiation pattern will everywhere be tilted above the horizon. It fires in the direction of the delay. So when in doubt, what a lot of guys will do when they put the antenna together is they'll lay it horizontal in the backyard, rotate it with a sensing antenna off in the far field, and measure where is the peak of beam. You're literally taking the elevation pattern by laying the antenna down sideways and rotating it. And although you're getting some ground reflection, it doesn't change the elevation angle when you're doing that particular measurement. So there's ways you confirm the elevation angle. A particular example is a buddy of mine over in New Jersey. He's very close to your town, Keensburg. He's there per example. A buddy of mine built a 10 gigahertz antenna, which was a vertical collinear of slots in a piece of waveguide, and because of a slight error that occurred, the upper slots were being fed later than the lower slots, and the beautiful beam that should have had 20 dB of gain or whatever was tilted above the horizon instead of that beaconing antenna on 10 gigahertz being able to be received 50 miles away. The person had trouble hearing it 1 mile away. So the good news when you build collinear-like antennas is you get lots of gain. The bad news is you take a couple of vulnerabilities on that if you're not careful, an awful lot of that effort could be temporarily wasteful until you find out what's going on. So be a little bit careful about that one. Is my forewarning on that one, Fred. Is it vertically collinear, vertically polarized that you're talking about with these J-poles? KC2OES, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay, I think you answered most of my questions. The only thing remaining is I have the photos if someone would like to see them. KC2OES.
Yeah, if you mail those, I'm listed in QRZ.com and lots of other places. I'm in the phone book, so on. So, yes, your memory of the photographs, but I'll make a pronouncement. In general, I do not answer questions by email. Mel has volunteered to do that. He's a retired person, truly retired, and he has volunteered to do that, and more power to him. I'm a very slow typer. I'm currently still employed, and I have not volunteered to answer questions in writing. I can speak 150 words a minute when I get excited, but I type at 10 words a minute, and it would take me forever. Okay, I think we've gone down the whole list of people who signed in with questions. Let me stand by to make sure I haven't missed anybody.
V2EO6.
Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, I did a Google search. I came up with something very interesting here. Software, amateur radio software by WB5KIA, Kilowatt India Alpha. And would you believe he has a program? I downloaded it. It's 100% free. It's for the TS-2000, and it even has speech recognition.
Wow. Sounds like you hit pay dirt real easily there, Rich.
Interesting.
So, amateur radio software, Whiskey Baker 5 Kilo India Alpha. Very nice. So, there are guys out there doing that. Although it's not quite the same. When I talk about software design radio, software control radios, there you're doing more of a Fourier transform type reception, which I guess we call digital signal processing, in which you're tailoring the passband, sweeping the passband, favoring certain portions of the passband over others to emphasize the signal-to-noise ratio of sideband speech, if that's what you want to emphasize, or maximizing it for Joe Taylor, WSJT-type modes of operation. There's all kinds of ways that a software-designed radio can give you great performance, and that's going to become the dominant phenomenon in the near future, is what I'm hearing. I'm a little bit amazed by that, but boy, that's a fantastic marriage of radio equipment and computing equipment. So, looks like our radios are all going to be networked together, very similar to automatic test equipment, all being commanded by one host computer with a beautiful display on our great big display device and our keyboard. Maybe even with a joystick, we're going to be controlling all of our radios. They're all automatically going to be sending CQ during contests, logging all the QSOs, automatically QSLing. I'm exaggerating a little bit, but we're apparently moving in that direction. In the old days, for instance, a valid contact used to be defined as a human being at one sitting in front of his rig, using his ears, interprets the signal, writes down the full set of call letters, the unknown piece of information like address or the RST signal, sends Rogers in both directions, and that sequence was used to be called a valid contact recognized by the authorities for ham radio. Now we have the WSJT technique of a computer sending out a series of tones. And when your other computer at the receiving end properly receives those tones, the tones could be buried 28 dB below the noise of your receiver, and it's likely to get something like 95% copy, and the message will be error checked and printed across your screen, and it will fulfill a cyclic redundancy code or a bit check or whatever. The message will be verified before it's flashed onto your screen. And as long as that message flashed on the screen follows certain criteria, that is now considered a valid contact. And it's almost 98% computer, and very little of that is human being. And there's a whole lot of screaming and hollering going on now among the Sirius VHF operators, among others, as to whether or not this should be counted as a valid contact. Because you've got guys out there who have been doing moon bounce, and it took them 8 years of their life to rack up a certain number of countries on moonbound, and now one, and they were using 16 Yagis and a kilowatt and a half dB noise figure preamp to do it. And nowadays, a guy with a yucky preamp, 150 watt single Yagi with an elevation control on the chimney of the house, and he's working the same amount of moonbound contacts, and he does it in 6 months instead of 8 years. But he's using WSJT to do it. And should he be under the exact same classification? Is that a level playing field? There's a lot of people out there worrying about that one. I'm pretty sure I know how the answer is going to be. Because this is the progress. This is the new breakthrough. This is the way of the future. It's going to be considered a valid contact, in my opinion. The only thing left to discuss is, are we going to have two different lists of people's accomplishments? One list, one list with computer-aided techniques and one without computer-aided techniques. That's the only thing left to discuss, as I see it. You can't call that a non-contact because it is modern-day communication, and it's a modern-day communication breakthrough. That's an opinion. Okay, I think we should find out what's going on in space. Or we didn't... I think you signed in last week, but I think you had to leave early. And when I got back to you, you weren't there, but maybe it was just the ghost of you that signed in, Paul. What is NASA doing, and when are they going to make the next launch? I know we got a beautiful, I think it's a gamma-ray telescope about to be launched real soon. WS2N, our space expert, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Question.
Person with the question, go ahead. Somebody said question. Who was that? Please give me a call letter and a set of name and a name. Okay, Paul, WS2N, go right ahead. And maybe Paul had to leave us. Okay. Mel, I think it's time to open up the mailbag. K2KEY, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Yeah, this is K2KEY. You know, it's funny, I haven't heard Paul lately. In fact, he usually checks in once in a while with me on 75 meters. And the last couple of weeks, I have not heard Paul at all. So hopefully everything's okay with him. Any comments? Yeah, I guess that's why I get... I'm still on CW. I am laughing. This past Monday, we had the straight key night. And everybody that was on the straight key mostly came on with a lot of old boat anchors. The oldest rig I spoke to a guy on was a rig from 1936, Collins rig of all things, using it from 1936. And then a couple other guys came on with rigs also from the 30s. And one guy had the original rig that I had, which was a single tube 6L6 built on a wooden chassis with a, you know, crystal oscillator. Oh, he was on with that, running 8 watts. And I was saying to myself, my Lord, boy, are we turning back the clock with all this. Anyhow, it was a lot of fun. Started on December 31st, 7 o'clock in the evening here, ran to Monday to 7 o'clock, and a lot of long QSOs and reminiscing with a lot of people about rigs and talking on CW with equipment that it's hard to believe that they're still on the air. I personally ran my old Johnson Viking 2 that I built back in 1957 and my NC-303 receiver. Still have them, and every year I fire them up and get on with the World War II, my father's World War II key. So when we start talking about FDR and all, it sure is a heck of a leap that stick. All right, I'm going to open up the mailbag here. Oh, yes, we got mail. Hang on a minute. Anyone want to make any comments about any of this before I go on?
I just wanted to comment and say in 1932, who would have imagined the radio going from 160 meters right up to 23 centimeters? And considering the fact that we were on to World War II, who would have expected that it would have been coming out of Japan? Yes, now in 2 years.
810, according to the analyzer. What do you suggest I do? Well, I think this is a good one with the Smith chart, but all right. We can tell them verbally, I guess, without going into the Smith chart. But this is actually a very good, you know, something to indicate track is actually you want to, you know, really physically see what's going on a piece of paper. I guess you can go to the Smith chart, but okay, Dick, you tell them what to do.
Okay, we had a bit of a double there between Rich and you, Mel, and Rich won. And Rich was telling us how amazed he is that his FT-2000, a Japanese-made rig, covers a huge frequency region from 160 all the way up to 1.2 gigs. essentially all-inclusive. And I agree with you, Rich, quite amazing. We've come a long way. Now, so therefore we missed the beginning of the question, Mel. I get the impression that the person wants to do some kind of visualization of the operation of a piece of equipment. Maybe it does or doesn't include a sense chart. And by the way, there is a way you can set a network analyzer so that it really does display a Smith chart. But so repeat the beginning of that question, Mel, go ahead.
Okay, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to jump on Rich that way. I didn't realize. I thought you did say open up the mailbag, Dick, over.
I sure did. Rich wanted to jump in with a quick comment. He assumed he could get there before you did, and he didn't time it quite right.
Okay, all right. Just a little bit fun. All right, no problem. Now, what this time was open, I opened the mailbag up. Did you get the first comment about straight T9? Did that come through? Over.
You sure did. That you were using your father's key. I wonder, was it a J38 type, a straight key? And your NC303, I forget what the transmitter was. Oh, yeah, a Johnson Viking 2, I think it was, that you had built. And so during the straight key night, that took place from, I think, 7 p.m. until 7 a.m. on New Year's Eve. And I had the impression that all of these 14 hours of QSOs were all done by Morse code. Is that correct? You guys must have switched over to voice during portions of that. Back to you, Mel.
It was 24 hours from 7 p.m. 31st to 7 p.m. January 1. No, all CW, all hand key. Yes, I used basically a J38. Yes, that's my father's World War II thing. Most pristine thing you ever want to see. Shine beautiful. Kept it wrapped up in a little sleeve, and I still keep it in that condition. And you know, this is fantastic. A lot of people I've asked this question. Do you know who made the J38T? A very famous company that made J38T. Do you have any idea who they are? Anybody over?
Who I know?
Yes, it's the God, Rich.
Wow. Lionel, amazing. By the way, Mel, you could use a little bit more audio. You sound good when we hear you direct, but when I listen to the amateurradio.tv recording, your voice being a little bit lower is a little bit more difficult to hear when it has been digitized. So you might want to speak a little bit closer to the mic. Over to you, Mel.
Okay, very good. I always thought that maybe I was pushing it a little too hard, but all right. In fact, I even cut it back here. But some people have complained that I was up against the edge of the repeater at times. But does this sound better to you, really? Over.
Absolutely, and you know we're being up against the edge of the repeater. In fact, I'm going to shout into my mic now. Say, the voice limiting built into my rig won't allow me to drastically overmodulate. You know we're near... banging up against the side of the repeater, Ramel, go ahead.
Okay, very good. All right, no problem. Very easy to do. All right, anyhow, the question was here, I put up a quad. I bought the materials, means from this company that sells quad material. You know, they sell the spider and a whole bunch of other peripherals that you make your own quad. And the problem is, he says that he can't get the feed point and key. Anything other than 100, or best he can do. I see the best I can do with the feed point impedance is 100 plus J10 ohms. So I was saying that this is a place that you, if you wanted to plot it, you know, on a Smith chart and actually see what's going on. But I guess we could tell him verbally. I could give him a very quick answer to this, Dick. But what would you suggest, over?
Okay. Every antenna that is electronically a little bit too long will be inductive. And every antenna that's longer, the resistive component goes up. So as he makes the antenna, the cubical quad driven element, as he makes that element shorter, the 10 ohms of inductance will disappear and start becoming 10 ohms of capacitance. However, all of my experience tells me is the inductive impedance moves very fast, the reactance moves very fast, versus length, but the resistance moves very slow. The 100 ohms represent the problem, and some other form of impedance matching will be required. Now, if his feed line is low enough and lost, and he's using his antenna tuner, even before he changes the length of the antenna, that'll work like a charm. And by the way, 100 ohms resistance and 10 ohms of reactance. My guess is that's something like a 2.2 standing wave ratio. Nothing huge. Easily handled by most antenna tuners. Antenna matchbox, whatever you're going to call it. But there's various ways that you can now rematch the antenna. And when it comes to a cubicle quad, I suspect you've got a lot more experience than I do, Mel. What would you do to impedance match that? Over to you, Mel.
Yeah, Roger. Well, I could, I haven't had that much experience on quads, Dick. I always found them somewhat cumbersome. And, I guess I got, off the idea of them years ago because the construction on the quads, whatever I saw, was what I would call flimsy years ago. And the guys always complained all the time after the winter, you got to rebuild it. Because, those days, it was a cheap antenna to put together, cheap beams to put together, because little or no aluminum was required. They used bamboo poles, and the spider that they used to take a piece of pipe and split the pipe, four ways to make the legs to hold the bamboo and just, more or less just screw it to those spiders. And it was very, flimsy type of construction. Fairly effective antenna, but like I say, didn't turn me on that type of put together that type of contraption to some extent. Especially to see ones that a multi-element one, they really look like who knows what. I figured it may attract a little too much attention, and especially 20 meter versions of it. So now, they remodernized it. The spider is, a cast aluminum frame, and the supports now are usually PVC type pipes, and also they more or less have brought it down to modern construction. So it's a different story. But getting back to his problem, I think the best thing I would do is just take a quarter wave piece of 59, RG59 coaxial cable, quarter wave, and match it up. I think it will take care of its problem. Nope, nothing really magical about that, Dick. Over.
Fantastic. You're absolutely right. When you use a quarter wavelength of cable of a different impedance in between your real cable and the load, that some other impedance. If that quarter wavelength of cable has the impedance that is the square root of the product, in his case, he's got roughly 100 ohms for the antenna, roughly 50 ohms for the feed line. Multiply the two together and take the square root. So it's going to come out very close to 75 ohms. So a quarter wave of 75 ohm cable is going to get rid of the 100 ohm resistive component, bring it down to 50. The 10 ohms of reactance, he can get rid of that by putting a small capacitor across the feed point of the antenna. That's one way of getting rid of it. The other way is to slightly make the driven element of a cubicle quad shorter. By the way, a cubicle quad gives you a lot of performance for the dollars. Very simple antenna, not much hardware, and a lot of performance. The only thing that usually goes wrong is that the way the wind blows the wire and the way the wire flops creates mechanical fatigue at the four corners, where the wire makes a 90-degree bend at each of the four corners. There the wire is being bent back and forth. Eventually it experiences metal fatigue, and that's where it breaks. So any technique you can come up with strain relief in that area, maybe a super great big blob of elastic adhesive or rubber boots, things like that. Some form of strain relief in the four corners will stop the mechanical fatigue. While I've got the floor, Mel, I'm going to break rank here for a second and ask an unrelated question, although it's slightly electronic, it's not very radio. I'm bringing a cable into a fuse box, and every fuse box has got these knockout plugs where you knock out a hole and you plug in the strain relief device that brings the cable in. In my case, I'm bringing in a very large diameter cable, so I'm trying to knock out a very large hole. And my particular fuse box has got these knockout plugs for the large hole, which has got about four or five rings inside of each other. And in the process of me knocking out that plug to try to put in the strain relief device, It came apart with too big a hole. And now I've got to put some of the ring back, if you know what I mean, to match the strain relief device. First of all, is there a scientific technique of knocking out just the right diameter of ring and the knockout plugs on the fuse box? Because I obviously got that wrong. And second of all, does somebody make a device that will make the hole smaller when I overdid it? Or do I have to solder back or weld back the missing piece, if you know what I mean? Back to you, Mel. K2RIW.
Yeah, well, they make reducer washers. No problem. Now you go into any electrical supply, and they got like reducer washers, say, from 1 inch to 3/4, or from 3/4 to 1/2 inch thick. And the reducer washer, you put one on each side. They're like beveled washers. In other words, the washer has like a bevel that fits the hole exactly, and then the extra piece of skirt. In other words, reinforces it. Do you follow what I'm saying, Dick? Over.
They're called donuts, KG2MPP.
Okay, so I got to buy some donuts. They've got a flange to them. They've got a step, or what is it called now? A countersink that fits the hole in there. And you're saying, rather than me try to solder back the piece that I took out that I shouldn't have, just to buy these donuts is the right way. And I'm sure a good electrical supply house will have them. My guess is even Home Depot will have them. Is that true, everyone aboard? Go ahead.
This I don't know. Yeah, it's possible. You got a lot of electrical supplies there. If you're just going to, you want to close the hole completely? In other words, you're not going to use it because then they got blank plugs also with the nuts, Dick, over.
No, in my particular case, I made the hole a little bit too big. I've got to reduce it by 1/8 of an inch all the way around. In other words, 1/4 of an inch total. And so I presume there's a kind of a donut that starts at my particular remaining diameter and then squeezes it down to the next smaller diameter. And I put one on the outside and one on the inside. Is that the right way to go, Mel? Go ahead.
Yeah, I know. I looked. I thought for sure they called reducer washers. Okay, they're called donuts, but all right. To me, they look like washers with a big, you know, like fender washers, but except they got a big hole in the middle and just extra, like, I guess you could call it like an extra bevel so that the two of them, that actually takes up the gap so they lay flat. In other words, that little bevel sticks into the hole. The hole the washer centered. You put another one on the inside, the outside, you know, and that two bevels come together so they stay permanent, you know, and doesn't slip up and down. Gives you, you know, when you tighten up on it, holds the connector right in the center of the thick over.
Fantastic. And I've, from time to time, I've always looked for very large diameter washers and had trouble finding them. So these reducer devices, donut-like things, that's the missing ingredient. Fantastic. Thank you, fellas. Back to you, Mel.
Okay, KC2QIQ for a quick comment.
Go right ahead, Clint.
Yeah, Dick, sometimes when you're trying to knock the little pieces out of the middle without knocking out the other ring, sometimes what I use is a socket set. But if you have deep sockets, they're really easy to hold on to. Just a little bit larger than the diameter of the one that you want to knock out. And in this way, you can either punch a screwdriver or something just on the other side to push it out and hold the socket from on the other side. This way it prevents the other rings from popping out.
Smart move. So use the right size socket to support the metal that I don't want to remove, and that way what I am hitting goes down the center of the socket. Very smart move. In fact, if I did that with something like a very large C-clamp, then it all could be a controlled operation. Is that the right way to do it, Glenn?
The C-clamp might be a little hard depending on the shape of the box to get it in, especially if there's sometimes on that long flat side in the back. But I find a lot of times that the minute you just hold the socket along the back, you can even just use a screwdriver. Sometimes, depending on the thickness of the box, you can almost push it out with your finger as long as you're supporting the back with a good solid socket.
Good suggestion. Well done. Thank you. You got it, Mel.
Okay. Usually, like I say, just bend it back a little bit just to make the crack and then take a good hefty pair of long nose pliers, grab it from the inside, and just, you know, work it up and down a few times so that, you know, you don't distort the box or whatever. And then, you know, after moving it up and down a few times, it'll break right off. All right, anyhow, but the reducer washers, though, we use them all the time in a lot of different installations. If you were here, I could most likely give them to you. I think there's a whole I got a whole, I still got my kit and all the junk that I cleaned out of my van when we, I retired. You hear that, Dick? I retired. Yeah. Technically, I'm retired. Just technically. What? Oh, my wife says, oh, yeah, you're only down 3 days a week now. Anyhow, so I can say I have my box. I had this electrical box because we were always, you know, putting transformers next to electrical boxes to power the systems up and all. So I always had these different types of devices to, you know, connect the transformer box to the power pump panel. And so I got all reducer washers and all that kind of stuff fixed. All right, if you have trouble finding them, you know, I could always, you'll give me an exact dimension. You know, I can look, put them in an envelope, basically, for you. If you can't pick them up for basically a few pennies a piece, I would assume. Can't be more than, you know, next to nothing. And if you, you know, if they say to you, you know, it could be you walk into an electrical place or something, you know, they say, oh, no, we only sell by the box picker. So if you have that problem, let me know, okay?
Good offer. But I live near so many Lowe's and Home Depot's and electrical supply houses that I've only got 10 choices as to where to go within the first 5 miles of my house. Mel, go ahead.
Hey, no, I'm just saying, just in case they say you only sell by the box. We only bought, you know, stuff, everything is by the box. So, like I say, if you need it, you can't buy even single pieces, you know, and always can put it in an envelope and pop them out to you. All right, let's go on. Let's see. What the heck? We went through that now. What the heck is this? I have picked up a device called a commercial C and KA fan application device called a pseudomorphic design amplifier. What? He picked it up at a ham fest, very cheap. Here's the gas set there, suitable for any use. Would you know anything about this? See, I don't even know what the heck is a pseudomorphic amplifier, Dick, over.
I've heard those words before, and I'm having trouble placing them. He did say C and KA. Now, C-band is around 4 gigs, 5 gigs. KA is around 24 gigs, 20 gigs. That's a big frequency range. Pseudomorphic hemp. Okay, that's a certain kind of a FET transistor. It's slowly coming back to me. And those transistors are very appropriate for that frequency region microwave. Let's call it 5 to 20 gigs. If you take transistors that are rated for 5 to 20 gigs or amplifier assemblies are rated for that frequency, and you try to use them at a much lower frequency, like 432 or 2 meters, in most cases, it's very difficult. I will admit that people have taken amplifier assemblies where you can climb inside of them on each individual stage, and you add little pieces of copper that are held down with a cyanoacrylate glue or a solder or epoxy, and you do what's called a snowflaking job. And by watching it on a spectrum analyzer or some other kind of instrumentation, while you're plugging through your favorite signal, and you keep adding little, to the strip line, you keep adding these little chunks of copper by putting one on the end of a toothpick with some kind of sticky substance, and you rapidly find out when you hold it near certain portions of the microstrip line that the performance improves. And you just keep adding those, and the performance doesn't improve anymore. So by snowflaking, you can take any amplifier where you have access to the individual stages, and you can pull it down in frequency. For all practical purposes, the technique does not work going up. Well, he's got what sounds like very high-frequency transistors, and pulling them down is possible. That's if it's not a complete amplifier assembly, a three-terminal amplifier assembly where it's all in one sealed package. In that case, making it work at the lower frequency usually is very difficult, and you can easily end up with parasitic oscillations because you're feeding it on 430 megacycles. It wants to give you amplification at 15 gigahertz, and it finds a way of oscillating at 15 gigs while you're driving it at 432. So it could be troublesome. fun thing to experiment with if you got the right kind of instrumentation. Let's hope he didn't pay a whole lot of money for it at the